Good morning, everyone. Well, I think, sadly, the context of this presentation is the ongoing damage and devastation in the northeast of the U.S. Due to the hurricane and superstorm. I think we have all seen the headlines last 2 days and coming from New York. We are constantly on a live feed from our friends and relatives about what's going on in our city. The context is important because here too we are seeing a lot of damage and potentially long-lasting health effects of water inundation and flooding. Now, our solution here in New York and all across the U.S. was largely technological. We are trying to outsmart the environment. Now, we have decided to focus on a polar region to examine how climate change in climate variability affect an indigenous community that has very little technological technology at their disposal to sort of outsmart the environmental change. We have collaborated with a number of people from the Northern Russia. Dr. Leonid Zubov was instrumental in the study. He is a physician who has practiced there for about 20 years, and the folks there call him the Tundra Doctor. And it's for a reason. And he's very proud of this title. We are now looking at the top of the globe. This is the northernmost point of the United States, Barrows, Alaska. We are studying an area right here, right above the Arctic Circle. It's the Nenets Autonomous Region. Called Nenetsky Autonomny Okrug. Okrug is the Russian for a region. Our main interest was in the increase of temperature and how the increase of temperature itself is affecting people's ability to move around and access healthcare. We know that in the U.S., in northern U.S. and northwest of Canada and in northern Russia, there's been a marked temperature increase from 1 to 2 degrees every decade. So if we project into the future, knowing that the trend has been unabated in the last 25, 30 years, we can see that in 100 years there is going to be a 10 to 20 degree centigrade increase in temperature, which essentially means the end of permafrost and end of many glacial systems that are now critical to the local ecosystems. Now, this is Russian Laika, the Russian Husky, looking at an area that was once tundra with no water. Every indented area in the tundra has the potential of being flooded because underneath the tundra there is a very thin layer of fertile soil, and after that there's 1 to 2 kilometers of permafrost of essentially frozen ground. So if you imagine this ground being defrosted gradually or rapidly, then anything that's indented will flood. And this is important to the native communities because people in the Arctic, especially in the Russian Arctic, are for the large part subsistence hunters, fishermen, and reindeer herders. So the ability to move around is critical, and so is ability to access health. The transportation is mostly not motorized. There is some use of aircraft and snowmobiles, but for the most part, people either walk or use reindeer. We are now transporting this one piece of the Russian Arctic, which is about the size of state of Washington. We are looking at the area in the red is the actual study area where we focused our analysis. It's It's home to about 8,302 indigenous Nenets, and the population density is on par with northern Alaska and the northwest of Canada. The 0.2 persons per square kilometer, if you can imagine 0.2 persons. We now are looking at the relief. So anything that's red is high peaks, unwalkable, and very cold. Anything that's in the green is low-lying sea level areas, and you know, and then so the gradient increases from dark green to red. So you can see that the most of the coast is very low-lying land. So any sea level rise or any water increase will affect these communities dramatically. We know that the only place where you can get healthcare in that region in the Canyon Peninsula, which is this piece of land that's sticking right into the Arctic point into the North Pole, is the Ness Village. It's a small village that has a 10-bed hospital and a full-time physician and two nurses that are stationed there. This is about, by the way, this is about 700 to 800 miles from the very tip all the way to the Ness Village, to the village at the mouth of the Ness River in blue. So it means that about 2 weeks of journey on tundra. The Nenets community is reliant on reindeer. Reindeer is everything. Reindeer is part of culture. It's a way of survival. It's a main source of protein. It's also skins. It's clothing. It's artifacts. There is the meat. The surplus meat is sold to the Russian non-indigenous population, and is a major economic force in the community. This family is actually a family of herders that is participating in our project. And this is their home. It's a transient camp right on the tundra. You can see the reindeer scattering around, and the chum, this is the traditional housing. Is basically a structure very similar to the American North American teepee. It's a long wooden poles from spruce and reindeer skins turned inward, so the fur is facing inside of the tent. The healthcare is sparse. Resources are very sparse. To get to the regional hospital in Naimar, it's about 2 to 3 hour flight from any point on Canyon Peninsula, and you can see that anywhere in the Arctic, the aircraft is grounded most of the time because of the weather conditions. So if there is an emergency, it doesn't mean that you will get an airlift. It just means that people will try to get to you as soon as possible, which means a couple of weeks away. Sometimes. Around this time of the year, there are many storms coming, so there's very few flight days. Now, our approach was to look at the temperature anomalies in the area, try to access the amount of or assess the amount of open water increase in the area, and look at the transmigration patterns and see how those are being affected by the increase of temperature and the increased water. This is a map that was done by the native community with the assistance of the Royal Norwegian Institute, where the reindeer herders drew maps of their migration patterns, and each clan has its own migratory path. It's been hundreds of years old. It's sort of a truck that you can see in the tundra, you actually can see it from satellite imagery. It's been there for a very long time. So any change in this pattern will affect persons. Culturally, it will affect them. It will affect the amount of feed that the reindeer get. It will affect also the distance that people need to travel from point A to point B. So what we went on to do is then look at some measure of health. There's very little in the way of data collection in the Arctic overall, and there's very little in the Russian Arctic. One outcome we could get is the arrival of persons to the local health center. And if you look at this graph, it's actually very remarkable. In 1980s and 90s, there's sort of a kind of a linear pattern when people the reindeer families came to the village to seek health care. So it's 46 weeks. And starting around 95, the arrival is later and later and later. So the question was, why is there such a change? So we went around and asked the herders, and the overwhelming response was, well, look, we have more and more water popping out in the tundra. We have to go around this water bodies, and where we come to the place where there is too much water, we have hundreds of heads of reindeer we can't cross, so we have to wait till it freezes. Now, the frozen period, the winter period, is shrinking. So the time when people can cross is shorter and shorter. As a result, they have to basically wait on the seaward side of the peninsula until the lakes and rivers are frozen, and only then they can cross. Now, we then said, well, how can we assess this? How can we actually measure the amount of water that's there on the landscape, and how can we construct some kind of long-term time series analysis? We went around, looked for data on this, and we basically found none, which posed the big problem. How do you analyze something like this? Being a mapping guy, I said, well, let's construct something, some maps on our own. And we ended up with a product that we call WaterMask that measures 250-meter pixels of water in the tundra and creates a composite image of water and ground. We then created this yearly maps that just have water and non-water. So everything that is black is solid ground, determined by the satellite imagery. Anything that's white are the water bodies, the lakes and the rivers. Okay. So now consider the change inter-annual change. So 2004 to 2006, 2004 was pretty dry year. 2006, however, was very wet and much warmer. So if you look at this image here, so this is 2004. When I moved to 2006, this is all new water. So those little white dots that pop up, I'll do it one more time. So this is the difference. And imagine on human scale, or animal scale, the reindeer scale, walking around and meeting all these new water bodies on your way, it is very problematic in terms of getting places. So we call this sort of the Google map for the tundra. And the area in a rectangular shape in the previous map is the same area on this map here. So the green are the little paths that the reindeer herders drew. And if we look at that same area in zoomed-in view using our maps, what we have is, this is 2004. So that lake right there was about 5 kilometers squared. Now, if I move to 2006, all these red pixels are the new water. So you can see it's not too much increase. However, if you are walking around and you are now trying to cross over to go south, go down, you know, in to the winter pastures, you are forced to go around this whole big lake system in order to get to the same back to your path, to your migratory path. So it's a big change. Now the same. So now we looked at the temperature change. And this is a temperature anomalies using station data. So anything that's in the red and yellow is increase above normal. Anything that's blue and green is decrease below the mean over the last 50 years. And you can see that starting around 1990, there's much more yellow and red than there is blue. This is a visualization of the same data. So anything that's yellow, it's increase. The green is the same, no change, and yellow is one to two degrees increase. So almost the entire coast of the area is in yellow. Now, when we plotted it, we got lowest plot that shows kind of no trend whatsoever, no change in secular trend, and then around 1990 there's a knot, and an increase, and the line is shooting up at about 1.4 degrees every decade, so significant in terms of daily life, but if we project this trend into the future, if the change is unabated, so we are talking about 14 degree increase plus minus our confidence interval, which is about 5.5 degrees. So very, very rapid change over a 100-year period if we were to project forward. Now, we have the question, of course, the big Dostoevsky question is, what is to be done? Right? How do you mitigate? What do you do? So one thing that we are working on now is to actually to make this technology available to the folks in the polar regions, to the villages, so that the villages themselves can and the nomadic peoples themselves can see the change and see where the new water is to plot the routes, because right now it's sort of, there is no Google map in the tundra, right? So there is no way to Google your way around. So as you're walking, if you're faced with a new river or new stream, and you can't cross it because the water is just above freezing, and you have loads of gear and animals with you, then you have to often go around till you get back to your path, which can take days, and is dangerous because you can also step on freshly frozen lake that wasn't there before, and you can fall through. We would like to expand it to the entire sort of polar north and be able to develop a product like this, so people actually can see the change chronologically, so the temporal change and spatial change in their environment. And so the idea is to improve the health access, to provide sort of methodology for ongoing monitoring, surveillance, environmental surveillance, and all of this hits on environmental justice and access to foodstuffs, to native foods, to resources that are now being compromised. This is the shot from the Mi-35 helicopter that's flying over tundra in the same region. You can see how much water there is, and you can see that. This is the northern edge of the migratory range. That's where the herders are heading when they go north. When they go south. It's warmer. It's more protected. There is firewood, and it's sheltered because they're mountains. So you can find low-lying areas where you can camp for the winter. Now to get from here to there, it's about 600-mile journey.
Wow.
This is my contact information. This would not be possible without the collaboration from the native people in Canyon Peninsula, without the Norwegian Royal Institute's assistance in mapping the migratory paths. And Nayara Bara is the name, is the thank you in the Nenis language. Thank you, and I look forward to questions.
Yeah, thank you very much. Do you have questions for Philip? Yes, please.
So there is a big difference between Canadian subsistence ways and the northern Russia. The reindeer in Russia are really they're domesticated animals. So they are in fact herders. The huskies are the herders, and the herds really move on their own trajectory, but they're followed by the herders. So we've looked at it in a very practical way. The longer you have to wait before you can cross from an area like Cannon Peninsula, the more weight you lose, because you're basically stuck in front of a water body that's not yet frozen. You can't go back. And there is limited food in the vicinity of where the pass ends before the water. So this area is get degraded very quickly. So the feed is disappearing. And it's actually, if you look at the area just before the crossing, now it's very barren because the reindeer have eaten all the lichen and have eaten all the grasses. So that effect is there. It's anecdotal. It's now, it's reported by the herders. We haven't measured the weight effect on the deer. This is something that would be great to do. Unfortunately, it requires requires weighing the animals, and it's a complex task. But that's something that we would be interested in doing. Yes. Well, it's a great question. It's all of this needs to be done in collaboration with the community there. So some of the answers I don't have, and I don't mean to duck the question. I just don't know how to best to do this. And I think without sitting down with the reindeer herders, we won't have the answers. The first question about the real time, the more real time it is, the better it is. Because, of course, if you have data from the last months, you know it's quite accurate. If it's, year-old data, then you don't really know whether there's a new lake popping out that you haven't, mapped yet. So the more real time, the better. The way to serve it, the easiest way to serve it is, is using one of the web platforms. So if it's a near real time map and you can zoom into the region, then it's quite good. If you can print it out and take it with you, it's even better. Now, if you can have it on some right. Well, the GPS is not always reliable in the Arctic, but
it's, yeah, if you could go with your GPS.
Yes. The issue with GPS is, it requires electricity, which there isn't any to be had in the tundra.
Charge it, yeah.
Right. You can't. Once you run out of juice on your unit, there isn't much you can do. So far we have used printed maps, and we've just put it in vinyl, in a little sleeve, and tape it over with duct tape. This seems to work. Now, of course, there is a sort of nicer way of doing it. But what the vinyl envelope actually does help you to do is you can have persons draw their actual map onto the map that you have provided. So you can actually then translate this information into, I didn't have the time to show the actual maps that the herders produce themselves, but they're very accurate. They really know the region so well. They can really pinpoint exactly where that lake was. They have done it for 30, 40 years. And the elders really know where they land. So there is no problem with them understanding the map. So the vinyl envelope actually works so far. And if you have a thin, small point permanent marker, then you can actually see where the past was as opposed to where the past was a year ago.
Okay, very good. And do you have any other questions for the panelists? I have a few questions myself. Please sit down and
thank you.
Three excellent presentations, and you can really see the whole span of environmental health. Isn't it amazing? The challenges that we all have to face, and by studying these issues and looking at ways of serving the communities better in their own environments, I think it's really fascinating. I have a question for Azeb. I was wondering if you had a chance to show these findings to the nurses in the hospitals and what their reaction was if you did.
Yes, we were giving all the data to the Federal Ministry of Health and also to the respective regional health bureaus.
Uh-huh.
So all those facilities where we have been giving training, where we have supplying material, we have checked just to show them all the gaps. And the improvement.
Okay. Were they surprised?
They were surprised.
So they thought they were doing better, probably. Mm-hmm. They were surprised.
But
and,
it has to be sustainable.
Good.
It has to be sustainable.
And have they included in maybe in their hospital development programs ways of keeping improving in
we're
waste management?
Them, to develop plan, the healthcare waste management plan. In the plan, the infection prevention committee could be organized there.
So who can
consist, from all over the units, starting from the supportive staff, the cleaners, the one who is working directly on around the final waste disposal.
Very good.
Part. So that is a great thing by itself.
Very
so planning,
good.
Planning, organizing,
good.
And providing them supplies. And then we are giving them training.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a
Excellent. Well, I hope that you stay in touch, and in a few years you tell us how much it has improved, and because I think you're a great leader, and you'll be able to help the health system keep improving their waste management so we don't do any more harm. And Peter, I was wondering about Poland as being part of the EU, and how much pressure there is for Poland to use the GMO in any other indirect or direct ways, and if there's also any impact of that on the local production of seeds
there's not much more pressure than any other country.
Good.
In terms of impact on seed production, there is a, can't tell you the figures.
Competition with the local,
the GM seeds form a significant portion of food production and use in feed. I can't precisely tell you.
I was wondering what the long-term impact of this could be, of having such regulation on the actual production in the country.
Well, it's to make things safe. It's to reassure the public. That's the number one key concern.
Good. Keep it safe.
Yeah.
That's good. Good. And Philip, in terms of the access to health care for the Nenets, do they have community health volunteers trained in their own community so that they can accompany them as they sort out all those waterways?
There was, during the Soviet times, there was a project called the Red Chum. Chum is the equivalent of...
community health worker,
Chum is TP.
The
Red Chum was, I guess, the was sort
a mobile,
of the Red Cross for the
Chum. A mobile clinic.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it was done in the Soviet times. There were persons trained, and they're still around. Right now, I don't believe there is ongoing training, which is too bad. But the reality is there aren't enough resources being dedicated to healthcare. Mm-hmm. The main thrust is the oil drilling because it's oil rich region. It's the second largest oil production region in Russia. So there's a lot of money going into this. Very little of it is actually
benefiting
the local people.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of encroachment of by the drilling companies on the land, the ancestral lands. So the answer is no, and I think that's something that would be very, very helpful.
Yeah, because I was thinking that as their paths get longer and longer, and if it now takes them 2 weeks to get to the next health center, it's going to be even worse. So having somebody that accompanies the clans in their migration, trained by them, with them, for them, could be a solution, because I don't think there's an easy solution to that massive flooding. So,
No. And just to add to this, I think the other important thing to consider is that the response among the native people in Siberia is very different than our sort of technology-based response to problems. So the thought is that we have adapted for last 10,000 years since last ice age. We have survived the Soviets. We have survived all kinds of climate change. We will make it through this one too. And so the idea is to kind
of wait
resilient.
And see.
That's
good. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But I was wondering the impact on that, especially on the health of women and children who are probably not as resilient as some of the other members. But it's fascinating. Are you going to continue working with this community?
We hope so.
Oh, great.
I
hope so, too. Yeah, because yes. I think they need somebody to advocate for them and speak for them. That's great. Thank you. Well, any other questions to our presenters? Yes, please go ahead.
When it comes to risk management, breakdown in risk communication, I think plenty more needs to be done in that area. The reasons you give, I think, mainly arise from the past food scares around the 90s, the mad cow disease, dioxin poisoning. I think it was just basic lack of trust amongst people that government at one stage said something and then they turned out to be wrong. So there's just a breakdown in trust, I think, and it's ESSA does its work very thoroughly, but they do the scientific assessment part. It's up to the risk management authorities to get the risk communication right, and I guess they're addressing that as best they can, but it's a huge task.
Mm-hmm. So there was no campaign to educate people regarding the risk?
It's fragmentary. It's more stronger in certain countries than others.
Mm-hmm.
It's not harmonized.
Not yet. Very good. Any other questions to our panelists?
Can I ask one?
Yes, please, go ahead.
So regarding the excellent work you're doing in Ethiopia, it seems like there may be a design solution to the incineration problem,
mm-hmm.
because
better incinerators. Yeah.
Well, better incinerators and some kind of sedimentization maybe that allows for quality control of how things are done.
Mm-hmm.
So the devices that I use, the stoves that you showed, they were built by individual health centers, hospitals. Based on, sort of, is there sort of an overarching kind of
floor plan? Like,
right, like how do you, bottom line, how do you do it properly?
Okay, but it's not organized system,
Okay.
Each hospital, each health center should have to design and to construct its own waste disposal system.
Okay.
So they don't have a floor plan.
It depends on the economic
like
situation.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on the budget.
Mm-hmm. They did their best, yeah. They did their best, yeah. Okay.
I just wonder if there is a way, I mean, that seems like it's calling for a technological solution. I wonder if there is a way to partner, you know, with a design team and just develop one. Yeah.
He will design the incinerator and you spread.
I was working under the United States of Government, you know, funded project.
Yeah.
So as a pilot project, we did on those five regions. Five health centers were our pilot projects.
Uh-huh.
So on those five pilot projects, we tried to do, you know, training. We tried to provide materials. We tried to maintain and even to construct at least a simple chamber incinerator. We tried to show to the health institutions, to the regional health bureaus, and at large to the federal ministry of health.
Mm-hmm.
That was the only thing we could do.
Yeah.
So that has to continue. They have seen.
Yeah, that's right.
All the improvement has been seen. So we followed after we did the pilot project. After 6 months of period of time, we did the follow-up assessment,
then
great improvement had been seen.
Oh,
all those data were to the federal ministry of health and to each regional health bureaus.
Excellent.
That's
good. Okay. So it would be good to have those floor plans uploaded in your website so everybody can build their
and
own incinerator.
It is uploaded in there.
Oh, great.
Thank you. That's great. Any other questions? No? Well, thank you very much. I hope you enjoy the rest of the conference.